Common Due Diligence Problems and Exposure Areas discusses a number of potential due diligence problems, a way for the buyer to ensure that the seller has been forthright in disclosing all material obligations and liabilities, whether actual or contingent, is to prepare an affidavit. An affidavit provides additional protection against misrepresentation or material omissions by the seller, its lawyers, and its auditors. The affidavit can be customized to a particular transaction and include the specific concerns that may arise during the transaction and afterward. Common due diligence problems and exposure areas. There is a virtually infinite number of potential problems and exposure areas for the buyer that may be uncovered in the review and analysis of the seller's documents and operations. The specific issues and problems will vary based on the size of the seller, the nature of its business, and the number of years that the seller, or its predecessors, has been in business. Clouds in the title to critical, tangible, real estate, equipment, inventory, and intangible, patents, trademarks, and so on, assets. Be sure that the seller has clear title to these assets and that they are conveyed without claims, liens, and encumbrances. Employee matters. There are a wide variety of employment or labor law issues or liabilities that may be lurking just below the surface, but will not be uncovered unless the right questions are asked. Questions designed to uncover wage and hour law violations, discrimination claims, OSHA compliance, or even liability for unfunded persons under the Multi-Employer Pension Plans Amendments Act should be developed. If the seller has recently made a substantial workforce reduction, or if you as the buyer are planning post-closing layoffs, then the requirements of the Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, WARN, must have been met. The requirements of WARN include minimum notice of 60 days prior to wide-scale terminations. The possibility of environmental liability under CERCLA or related environmental regulations. Unresolved existing or potential litigation. These cases should be reviewed carefully by counsel. A seller's attempt to dress up the financial statements prior to sale. Often this is an attempt to hide inventory problems, research and development expenditures, excessive overhead and administrative costs, uncollected or uncollectible accounts receivable, unnecessary or inappropriate personal expenses, unrecorded liabilities, tax contingencies, and other such issues. Affidavit regarding liabilities. State of blank, county of blank. Prospective seller, being of lawful age and being first duly sworn upon her oath, states, 1. I am the sole shareholder of the S Corporation, which trades under the name Seller Co., and I have full right to sell its assets as described in the bill of sale dated blank. Those assets are free and clear of all security interests, liabilities, obligations, and encumbrances of any sort. 2. There are no creditors of Seller Co. or me, or persons known to me who are asserting claims against me or the assets being sold, which in any way affect the transfer to prospective buyer of the trade name Seller Co., its goodwill, and its assets, including the equipment as set forth in the bill of sale dated blank. I agree to pay all gross receipt and sales taxes and all employment taxes of any sort due through closing. I am current in regard to these taxes and all other taxes, and there are no pending disputes as to any of my taxes or the taxes of Seller Co. 3. There are no judgments against Seller Co. or me in any federal or state court in the United States of America. There are also no replevins, attachments, executions, or other writs or processes issued against Seller Co. or me. I have never sought protection under any bankruptcy law, nor has any petition in bankruptcy been filed against me. There are no pending administrative or regulatory proceedings, arbitrations, or mediations involving Seller Co. or me, and I do not know and have no reasonable ground to know of any proposed ones or any basis for any such actions. 4. There are no known outstanding claims by any employees of Sellerco or me, and I expressly recognize that no claims of, by, or on behalf of any employees arising prior to closing are being transferred to prospective buyer. 5. There are no and have been no unions that have been or are involved in any business that I own, and particularly Sellerco. Furthermore, there currently is no union organizational activity underway in any business that I own, and particularly Sellerco. 6. There are and have been no multi-employer pension plans or other pension or profit-sharing plans involved in any business that I own, and particularly Sellerco. 7. I have always conducted Sellerco according to applicable laws and regulations. 8. From the time when the purchase agreement was executed through closing, I have conducted the business called Sellerco only in the usual and customary manner. I have entered into no new contracts and have assumed no new obligations during that time period. 9. I shall remain fully liable for payment of all bills, accounts payable, or other claims against Sellerco or me created prior to closing. None of them are being transferred to prospective buyer. 10. I hereby warrant and represent to prospective buyer that all statements in paragraphs 1 through 9 of this affidavit are true and correct. 11A. I agree to indemnify and hold harmless prospective buyer in respect to any and all claims, losses, damages, liabilities, and expenses, including, without limitation, settlement costs and any legal, accounting, and other expenses for investigating or defending any actions or threatened actions reasonably incurred by a prospective buyer in connection with, 1. Any claims or liabilities made against prospective buyer because of any act or failure to act of myself arising prior to closing in regard to Sellerco, or 2. Any breach of warranty or misrepresentation involved in my sale of Sellerco to prospective buyer. 11B. As to claims or liabilities against prospective buyer arising prior to closing in connection with Sellerco, or any claim arising at any time in regard to any profit-sharing or pension plan started prior to closing involving Sellerco, or any breach of warranty or other material misrepresentation made by me, I agree that prospective buyer has the option to pay the claim or liability and deduct the amount of it from any money owed to me after giving me reasonable notice of the claim and reasonable opportunity to resolve it. This right of set-off expressly applies to any damages prospective buyer suffers as a result of any breach of any warranty I have given to prospective buyer. Prospective buyer's right of set-off against any money owed me shall not be deemed his exclusive remedy for any breach by me of any representations, warranties, or agreements involved in the sale of Sellerco to him, all of which shall survive the closing and any set-off made by prospective buyer. 12. I agree to execute any further documents to complete this sale. Prospective seller, subscribed and sworn to before me this blank day of blank, 20 blank, notary public. My commission expires blank. Note, proper use of this affidavit depends on the exact type of purchase agreement used. The emergence of virtual data rooms. It appears that the age of bad hotel rooms, expensive travel costs, and bad donuts in classic due diligence data rooms is slowly but surely being replaced with virtual data rooms, or VDRs. Virtual data rooms use existing computer software and internet technology to provide a secure online format for reviewing and organizing due diligence information. The documents are easier to search and index when they are already online, and the use of a VDR prevents water cooler rumor mills about what the guys in suits are doing in the corner conference room. The VDR does require the company's IT department to be involved early and often in the overall selling process. The VDR also better facilitates the review of certain types of data that are easier to review online and in electronic form, such as CAD drawings, video files, patent filings, and architectural drawings. Are VDRs growing in acceptance? It appears so. Intralinks, www.intralinks.com, a leading provider of VDR software and systems, handled 50 transactions in 2001, 450 in 2004, and predicts being a technology provider to 1,500 transactions in 2005. In January of 2009, it was reported that Intralinks had facilitated 55,000 projects and transactions, and it had 6 consecutive years of double-digit growth. By 2016, virtual data rooms had hosted hundreds of thousands of transactions, and Intralinks alone was used by 3.1 million professionals on transactions valued at over $13 trillion. Significant portions of the due diligence process have shifted online. However, these technology tools should be used as an asset and not a crutch. There is still no substitute for problem-specific due diligence being done on a face-to-face basis, where interactivity, follow-on questions, body language, and voice inflection can be very enlightening and revealing. Conclusion. Due diligence must be a cooperative and patient process involving both the buyer's and the seller's teams. Any attempts to hide or manipulate key data will only lead to problems down the road. Material misrepresentations or omissions can, and often do, lead to post-closing litigation, which is expensive and time-consuming for both parties. Another mistake in due diligence that sellers often make is to forget the human element. I have worked on deals where the lawyers were sent into a dark room in the corner of the building without any support or even coffee. On other deals, we were treated like royalty, with full access to support staff, computers, telephones, food, and beverages. It is only human for the buyer's counsel to be a bit more cooperative in the negotiations when the seller's team is supportive and allows counsel to do his job. Appendix to Chapter 5. Post Sarbanes-Oxley Due Diligence Checklist. In the 1990s, acquirers rarely had the opportunity to conduct extensive, time-consuming due diligence. Buyers were seldom granted exclusivity periods, and the typical auction might have allowed the potential buyer only a day or two in the data room, which sometimes had a no-copy rule, and a few hours of management interviews. After the Enron scandal and a few others hit the American corporate world, the Public Company Accounting Reform and Investor Protection Act of 2002, also known as the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, SARBOX, was enacted, which changed the way in which businesses were conducted and corporate governance was practiced. SARBOX lays out a government-mandated disclosure process that is monitored by auditors, certified by top-level executives under penalty of prison, and reviewed by the SEC. It addresses corporate responsibility, the creation of a public company accounting oversight board, auditor independence, and enhanced criminal sanctions. The effect of SARBOX has been to compel investment banks, regulators, shareholder groups, plaintiffs' lawyers, and other parties to analyze companies with a focus on the broad mandates of SARBOX. SARBOX does not apply only to large publicly traded corporations. Privately held companies can also be subject to SARBOX. Lenders and customers can each require a company to adopt SARBOX-style procedures. A company's accountants and its directors and officers, D&O, insurance carrier, can also prompt a company to do so. The disclosure requirements. Potential acquirers must be aware of the main federal corporate disclosure requirements, Regulation SK, SFAS No. 5, and SARBOX. Regulation SK. Regulation SK, issued by the SEC, acts as an instruction manual for public companies filing their annual, quarterly, and interim reports. The important provisions are as follows. 1. Item 101 requires reporting companies to describe their businesses, products, and competition, as well as report on their financial position by industry segments. Companies must discuss transactions outside of the ordinary course of business, R&D activities, intellectual property, backlog, foreign operations, and the anticipated costs and effects of environmental compliance, both current and projected. 2. Item 103 calls for companies to disclose any large non-routine legal proceedings to which they are a party, and even some routine matters that exceed certain thresholds. Also, Item 103 requires a company's management to discuss known trends, events, and uncertainties that could have a material effect on its business. 3. Item 402 calls for a detailed review of the company's executive compensation, employee contracts, benefits, options, and so on. 4. Item 404 focuses on related party transactions. Material contracts are to be included as exhibits to the periodic filings. So many times credit agreements, joint venture agreements, and even real estate leases are on the public record. SFAS number 5. Statement of Financial Accounting Standards number 5, accounting for contingencies, issued by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, deals with disclosing loss contingencies. Observing SFAS number 5 is part of complying with generally accepted accounting principles and is a key element in the audit letter process. It requires a company to establish a loss contingency in its financial statements if, 1, available information indicates that it is probable that the company has suffered a loss, 2, the amount of that loss can be reasonably estimated. Sarbanes-Oxley. SARBOX introduces stringent disclosure requirements for companies. The main disclosure requirements that a potential acquirer must keep in mind are as follows. 1. Section 302 of SARBOX requires the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer of a company to personally certify certain items about the annual or quarterly report being filed. In summary, they must certify that they have read the report. The report fairly presents the company's financial condition and results of operations. To their knowledge, the report contains no untrue statements or omissions of material fact that would make the statements misleading. They are responsible for and have evaluated the company's disclosure controls and procedures and its internal controls over financial reporting. 2. Under Section 906 of SARBOX, senior officers can be subject to potential criminal liability if they falsely, knowingly, or willfully make an inaccurate Section 302 certification. These provisions together obligate the buyer's CEO and CFO to certify the financial statements and internal disclosure controls of the combined company as of the end of the first quarter post-acquisition. In major acquisitions, this can be an impossible task if substantial due diligence was not done prior to the closing. 3. Under Section 404, a company has to establish and maintain adequate internal control structures and processes to allow for accurate financial reporting. In the company's annual report, senior executives need to assess and report on the effectiveness of these internal control structures and processes. Furthermore, the company's auditors must provide an independent report on management's assessment. Taken together, these measures require reporting companies, and companies otherwise observing these requirements, to review their liability assessment and reporting practices, and if necessary, adopt new ones. Regularly obtain and evaluate insurance company risk assessments for the company's properties. Include environmental matters in their Item 303 Management Discussion and Analysis. Discuss pending and threatened litigation and regulatory enforcement actions in their periodic reports. Disclose and value contingent liabilities in their financial statements, including those related to legal, operational, warranty, and environmental issues. Implement and periodically evaluate Section 404 Internal Controls and Procedures. Perform the actions called for by their internal controls and procedures, including maintaining internal records, establishing milestones for regularly evaluating known problem areas, searching out new problem areas, and providing reports up and down the management chain. Have all of the above reviewed, evaluated, and certified by senior management? Have all of the above formally reviewed and audited by their accountants? Among other things, audit committees must enact whistleblowing procedures to report questionable accounting or auditing practices. The buyer should also compare the target's internal controls with its own to identify any deficiencies or differences. This will enable the buyer to prepare integration steps to harmonize both sets of control procedures after closing. In particular, acquiring companies need to expand their review of publicly available information to include the EPA Enforcement and Compliance History, ECHO, list, and periodic reports filed by the target with the SEC. Specifically inquire about their target's internal review processes and procedures. Review the target's internal operational, real estate, intellectual property, insurance, litigation, and environmental policies. Examine the internal committees charged with monitoring and assessing the target's SARBOX compliance, including getting a list of committee members and their functions. Consider whether other internal procedures might touch on managerial, financial, and operational issues, for example, as part of the target's accounting and legal functions. Inquire about what is generally known as the Disclosure Controls Committee, a general oversight committee that may gather and evaluate information generated by the internal review structure. Obtain all minutes, reports, memoranda, and valuations generated by these internal procedures. Review the work papers and reports generated by the target's auditors while assessing the company's internal controls. As a result of Sarbanes-Oxley, the duties of the audit committee have substantially increased. A review of committee minutes often uncovers potentially important issues. How the committee has resolved these issues may indicate its effectiveness and independence. The process used by the target's audit committee to select its outside auditor, as well as the target's relationship with its outside auditor, should also be examined. Comparing the amount of money spent on non-audit services with the amount spent on the audit itself may suggest the relative importance of each to the auditor. If non-audit services are significant, the buyer should consider potential exposure to bias that could affect the integrity of the audit. GAAP practices often allow for discretion, and to the extent that the target's accounting practices differ from the buyer's, the differences need to be harmonized. The buyer should recognize the potential impact that this may have on the combined company's earnings. For example, buyers should pay attention to the target's policies for accounting for contingent liabilities. If the buyer's accounting practices are more conservative, that is, if they will result in greater reserves, the impact of this must be understood and taken into account in the buyer's evaluation. Checklist of items post-SARBOX. Thus, SARBOX and the SEC rules promulgated thereunder have profoundly affected important aspects of M&A practice in a number of ways, including the nature and scope of the due diligence process and the terms and conditions under which the transaction is affected. In conducting due diligence and in crafting appropriate representations and warranties in deal documents, particularly with respect to closing conditions and material adverse effect or change, MAE or MAC clauses, public company buyers must consider the following SARBOX-related items. 1. Does the seller maintain effective disclosure controls and procedures? Have the disclosure controls and procedures been followed consistently in crafting the seller's public disclosures? Does the seller have a disclosure committee? And if so, what function has it played in reviewing the seller's public disclosures? What is the role of the general counsel? What is the outside auditor's role in the process? Some buyers will insist on having their outside auditors evaluate the seller's financial statements and communicate with the seller's outside auditors without the seller's management present. Access to the seller's outside auditors will be a critical part of the due diligence process. Does the audit committee or another independent committee of the board of directors oversee the effective operation of the seller's disclosure controls and procedures? What do the minutes of the relevant committee meetings reflect, if anything, in this regard? 2. Does the seller maintain effective internal control over financial reporting? Many companies have had to include a management report on internal control for the first time in their 2004 10-Ks in accordance with Sarbanes Section 404 and the SEC's implementing rules. Hence, the question has arisen whether the report of the buyer's management must encompass the seller's internal control, even if the seller's operations may not be fully integrated into those of the buyer. The SEC staff has acknowledged that it might not always be possible to conduct an assessment of a seller's internal control over financial reporting within the period between the consummation of the merger and the date when the buyer's management must make its own assessment of internal control for the combined company. Question 3 of the SEC staff's June 2004 FAQs on internal control allows the buyer's management to defer reporting on the seller's internal control, but only if the buyer's management refers in its 404 report to a discussion in its Form 10-K explaining the basis for the limited scope of management's assessment, that is, why the 404 report excludes the seller's business. Additionally, the staff indicates in this FAQ that the period in which management may omit an assessment of an acquired business's internal control over financial reporting from its own internal control assessment may not extend beyond 1 year from the date of acquisition, nor may such assessment be omitted from more than one annual management report on internal control over financial reporting. Notwithstanding the accommodation from the SEC staff, can the seller's management give a clean internal control assessment? This must be determined during the due diligence process and provided for in the seller's representations and warranties. If the seller is a public company, is it likely to receive a clean audit from its independent auditor on the seller's internal control over financial reporting? As noted, this assessment is required, beginning in the 2004 fiscal year from many companies' management under Section 404 of Sarbanes. Companies that report to the SEC on a calendar year basis and their outside auditors already should be assessing the effectiveness of existing financial reporting controls with a view toward remediation where necessary or appropriate. We understand that the Big Four accounting firms have been signaling to audit clients that they may have material control weaknesses that could preclude the auditor from issuing a clean report as of the close of the December 31st fiscal year end. Nor could management conclude that the company's internal control was effective in the event of a material weakness. If the seller has any internal control problems, how will they be corrected? And even if they are corrected, is there sufficient potential liability exposure on the part of the buyer to warrant abandonment of the deal? What sort of disclosure will be made at a minimum in the seller's pre-closing 10-Qs and 10-Ks regarding possible control deficiencies identified during the due diligence process? Have the CEO and the CFO of public sellers provided the required SEC certifications under Sections 302 relating to both disclosure controls and procedures and internal control over financial reporting and 906 of Sarbanes? 3. Are there any issues relating to the seller's financial statements that are significant enough to interfere with the ability of the buyer's CEO and CFO to certify SEC reports in the future? Have there been any recent waivers of or amendments to the seller's code of ethics under Section 406 of Sarbanes, applicable to the seller's CEO, CFO, and other senior financial officers? If the seller's stock is listed on a national stock exchange or quoted in NASDAQ, has the seller established the broad-based ethics code called for by the exchange or NASDAQ under Sarbanes-induced revisions to self-regulatory organization, SRO, governance listing standards? Is there any evidence that either or both codes are not being enforced? Have there been any concerns or allegations regarding auditor independence? For example, have activist institutions withheld votes from audit committee members because of a perception of excessive non-audit fees paid to the outside auditor? Has the seller's audit committee fulfilled its enhanced oversight role under Sarbanes? Note likely requests from buyers for access to audit committee meeting minutes, whistleblower procedures and documentation of complaints and pre-approval policies. Have there been any recent whistleblower complaints received by the audit committee, and if so, how were they handled and by whom? The buyer may request access to logs and other documentation relating to the treatment of such complaints, at least where they pertain to accounting and auditing matters and or possible CEO-CFO ethics code breaches. If the seller's stock is listed on the NYSE, Amex, or NASDAQ, are the seller's corporate governance practices sufficient under the enhanced governance listing standards adopted by these markets under Sarbox? If any of the seller's directors will serve on the buyer's board, are there any independence issues from the buyer's perspective? Are there any loans or extensions of credit to the seller's executive officers and directors in violation of Section 402 of Sarbox? Chapter 6. The Board's Role in M&A. Boards of directors are playing an increasing and critical role in M&A transactions in 2017 and beyond. Boards must embrace key principles of due diligence, buy versus build analysis, financial analysis, and risk assessment as primary factors in their decision-making and evaluation process, both for M&A as well as other capital investment proposals. Transactions should help drive shareholder value and be aligned with both short-term and long-term strategic objectives. They should be accretive, not dilutive, to the market price of the company's shares, as well as to the company's brand, reputation, and to consumer perception of its core products and services. Transactions must be structured and implemented in a manner where they will be able to withstand second-guessing and searching by an increasing pool of shareholder activists and by courts who seem increasingly more willing to play Monday morning quarterback in their analysis of transactions. Screens and filters need to be in place to ensure that risk is avoided and strategic objectives are met. Analysis must be conducted to predict and mitigate any post-closing litigation risk or costly post-closing integration challenges. The new corporate governance paradigm and state of the law is that boards can and will be held accountable and responsible for misguided strategies and/or transactions that are not carefully assessed and evaluated. Boards and company leaders must embrace and understand the notion that there is no more complicated transaction than a merger or acquisition. The issues raised are broad and complex, from valuation and deal structure to tax and securities laws. It seems that virtually every board member executive in every major industry faces a buy or sell decision at some point during her tenure as leader of the company. In fact, it is estimated that some executives spend as much as one-third of their time considering merger and acquisition opportunities and other structural business decisions. The strategic reasons for considering such transactions are also numerous, from achieving economies of scale to mitigating cash flow risk via diversification to satisfying shareholder hunger for steady growth and dividends. The federal government's degree of intervention in M&A transactions varies from administration to administration, depending on the issues and concerns of the day. Recent years have witnessed a significant increase in merger and acquisition activity within a wide variety of industries that are growing rapidly and evolving overall, such as healthcare, information technology, education, and software development, as well as in traditional industries such as manufacturing, infrastructure, consumer products, and food services. Many developments reflect an increase in strategic buyers and a decrease in the amount of leverage, implying that these deals were being done because they made sense for both parties. That was far from the case with the highly leveraged, financially driven deals of the late 1980s. Boards of companies in small to middle market segments need to understand the key drivers of valuation, since they are often able to focus their operating goals to maximize the potential valuation range. Therefore, it is important to know that the valuation of the target company directly correlates with the following characteristics. 1. Strong revenue growth. 2. Significant market share or strong niche positions. 3. a market with barriers to entry by competitors. 4. A strong management team. 5. Strong, stable cash flow. 6. No significant concentration in customers, products, suppliers, or geographic markets. 7. Low risk of technological obsolescence or product substitution. Successful mergers and acquisitions are neither an art nor a science, but a process. In fact, regression analysis demonstrates that the number one determinant of deal multiples is the growth rate of the business. The higher the growth rate, the higher the multiple of cash flow the business is worth. For example, boards on both the buy side and sell side of the transaction need to understand that when a deal is improperly valued, one side wins big, while the other loses big. By definition, a transaction is a failure if it does not create value for shareholders. The easiest way to fail, therefore, is to pay too high a price. To be successful, a transaction must be fair and balanced, reflecting the economic needs of both buyer and seller, and must convey real and durable value to the shareholders of both companies. Achieving this involves a review and analysis of financial statements, a genuine understanding of how the proposed transaction meets the economic objectives of each party, and recognizes the tax, accounting, and legal implications of the deal. A transaction as complex as a merger or acquisition is fraught with potential problems and pitfalls on both sides of the table. Many of these problems arise either in the preliminary stages, such as when the parties force a deal that shouldn't really be done, that is, some couples were just never meant to be married. Other times, inadequate, rushed, or misleading due diligence results in mistakes, errors, or omissions. Risks are not properly allocated during the negotiation of definitive documents, or it becomes a nightmare to integrate the companies after closing. These pitfalls can lead to expensive and protracted litigation unless an alternative method of dispute resolution is negotiated and included in the definitive documents. The board can and should play a key role in overseeing the M&A deal team and C-level executives in making sure that valuations are accurate and being assessed properly, that due diligence is complete, and that the integration that follows a deal does not undermine the company's very reason for doing the deal to begin with. When boards fail to play an active role in the deal process, a company can wind up entering into a transaction that it later regrets. Classic mistakes include a lack of adequate planning, an overly aggressive timetable to closing, a failure to really look at possible post-closing integration problems, or, worst of all, that projected synergies turn out to be illusory. By engaging in the M&A process early and often, developing a strategy and process, and carefully overseeing the role of the executive team, a board can make sure that a company does not make any of these classic mistakes. Specific board responsibilities. Generally, proposing, planning, and implementing M&A transactions are the responsibility of a company's executive team. With the board's oversight, it is the executive team that will develop the acquisition plan that leads to M&A transactions. But that does not mean that the board won't play an integral role in the M&A process. The board must act in a way that is consistent with its fiduciary duties as caretakers and gatekeepers of the company's tangible and intangible assets. An engaged board will develop the company's overall strategic direction and might determine that growth should be driven through acquisition. In the alternative, it might determine that the best way for a company to maximize value to shareholders is to sell itself or certain of its key assets. The board must understand that its decision-making process, the depth and breadth of the information it considered to make its decision, and the reasonableness of the board's actions will all be under the microscope as viewed by shareholders, stakeholders, regulations, activists, and possibly even the courts. It is in this environment that the company's executive team will develop a specific acquisition strategy, which might lead to the identification of M&A targets, perhaps with the help of an investment bank or other advisors. The board will also identify and assess key risks, supervise and test the premises of a proposed transaction, and ensure that the M&A transaction being proposed by the company's executive team will be in the best interests of the company and ultimately drive shareholder value. If the company wishes to sell, the board will give its input into that approach as well as evaluate various offers and determine whether a deal being offered is fair and maximizes value for shareholders. The board's role in the context of M&A can be broken into its macro roles and micro roles. In the macro, the board should embrace and meet its various fiduciary obligations. This will be addressed further in the next section. Oversee the company's management as it negotiates the contours of a particular deal. Test and confirm the economic premise of the proposed transaction, namely perform its own analysis of the management's justification for doing the deal to see if it reaches the same conclusion. Confirm the value proposition that the deal offers to the company's shareholders. Confirm that management has taken necessary steps to mitigate the risk of the transaction and reduce the chances of conflict and litigation later on. Assist management in addressing the fear, uncertainties, and doubts of employees and company teams. Confirm that management is planning the post-closing integration adequately. In the micro, the board should confirm compliance regarding timing and scope of disclosure of the transaction to various constituencies, particularly with an eye toward prevention of any insider trading. Consult with the executive team regarding the due diligence process to make sure that all necessary steps have been taken to mitigate post-closing risk. Confirm that the company has obtained key third-party approvals, whether regulatory or contractual. In some instances, the board may actually assist the company in this respect. Review the allocation of purchase price to confirm that allocation of the risks and rewards of the transaction is fair and reasonable relative to upside. Key functions and issues. Evaluate, oversee competencies of company's leadership team to execute, manage M&A and post-closing. Set overall growth strategy, including M&A, buy versus build, etc. Review and analysis of M&A plan, alignment with strategic plan and mission, values, key criteria, screens and filters, etc. Degree of board involvement based on size, impact, complexity of proposed transaction. Oversight over allocation of time and resources of the company leadership team, gatekeeper role. Experience of the overall board and individual members with M&A. Roles and responsibilities of key external advisors. Legal responsibilities. The board's responsibilities with respect to M&A go well beyond providing strategic advice and oversight. The board's obligation to drive shareholder value results from its fiduciary duties to the company. Fiduciary duties are legal obligations, which fall into two broad general categories, the duty of care and the duty of loyalty. When directors violate these duties, courts may impose monetary liability upon them or may invalidate or enjoin their actions. The key starting point for understanding the nature and scope of these duties and how they dictate the board's role in M&A is considering what actions and decisions a court will not disturb. Under the business judgment rule, directors are presumed to have made a business decision on an informed basis, in good faith, and in honest belief that their actions were taken in the best interest of the company. And when they do in fact act in this manner, directors will not have their decisions second-guessed by a court, even if the decision turns out to be a bad one. That is, directors' fiduciary duties do not bar them from taking business risks, and courts generally are not in the business of substituting their business judgment for that of directors, or otherwise engaging in substantive evaluations of business decisions or outcomes. So, when will a court disturb a business decision made by a board of directors or impose liability on such decision-makers? When the directors act in a manner contrary to the presumptions of the business judgment rule, that is, when they fail to act on an informed basis, in good faith, or in honest belief that their actions are in the best interest of the company. These are issues that judges and lawyers are in a position to scrutinize. Business expertise is not necessary. The focus of the judicial review, therefore, is on the process undertaken by the board, particularly whether that decision-making process was materially flawed or inadequate, or whether it was tainted or driven by personal interests instead of by the company's interests. These concepts are embodied in the director's duties of care and loyalty. Duty of care. When making a decision, directors must actively gather material information regarding the company's affairs and then act upon that information with the diligence, care, and skill necessary to make a rational business decision. Board members are entitled to rely primarily on the data provided by officers and professional advisors, provided that they have no knowledge of any irregularity or inaccuracy in the information, but they cannot act in a grossly negligent manner. That is, they risk breaching their duty of care when they remain willfully ignorant of material information, or even when in possession of such information, rush a decision so they cannot reasonably and responsibly evaluate the options. I've even seen cases in which board members were held personally responsible for misinformed decisions if their duty of care was not taken seriously. In the context of selling the company, the duty of care means that the board must undertake reasonable efforts to secure the highest price realistically achievable given the market for the company. This standard is actually tougher than the one courts employ when applying the business judgment rule to ordinary board decisions, which, as noted above, only requires that the board act in an informed manner, in good faith, and with the assumption that its actions are in the best interests of the company. Because in the context of M&A, the board has Revlon duties when looking at a board's actions in a sale, the court will take a substantive look at what a board did to get the highest reasonable price. Because the board has these Revlon duties, it should develop a process whereby it will maximize shareholder value, which drills down into fair pricing, fair dealing, and a strong plan for post-closing integration and value maximization. While not a requirement under Revlon, the board may engage in an auction process to fetch the highest price for the company. It also might mean that once the company receives an offer, the board should actively seek additional offers to make sure that the company is getting the best deal possible. In any event, the board should be well educated on various devices it can employ to make sure the company is getting the best deal. Furthermore, the board should carefully document its role in the M&A process and the various steps it took to maximize the sale price so that it can demonstrate that it undertook such reasonable efforts. Consider how the Delaware Chancery Court viewed the possible sale of NetSmart Technologies Incorporated. Its decision in re NetSmart Technologies Incorporated, Shareholders Lit, criticized NetSmart's board's decision to only consider private equity firms as potential buyers to the exclusion of strategic buyers. The court also criticized the board's failure to keep minutes of an important meeting where this decision was made. This emphasizes the point that process and record-keeping are important if a board is not going to breach its fiduciary duties during the M&A process. Recent Delaware cases have established that, in a limited set of circumstances, the business judgment standard may apply in the context of M&A. In In re MFW Shareholders Litigation, Delaware Chancery, May 29, 2013, referred to as MFW, the Delaware Chancery Court held that the board satisfies its duty when reviewing a going private transaction with a controlling stockholder if the merger receives the approval of either 1. A special committee of directors independent of the controlling stockholder that is fully empowered to decline the transaction, and such committee relies on its own advisors and satisfies the duty of care in negotiating the sale price, or 2. A majority of the stockholders not affiliated with the majority stockholder, provided that such stockholders are uncoerced in their vote and fully informed. Another recent Delaware Chancery Court case, In re Volcano Corporation stockholder litigation, demonstrates that the MFW logic can apply to other situations as well. In Volcano, the court determined that the tendering of shares by a majority of fully informed, uncoerced, disinterested stockholders essentially has the same effect as a majority vote of unaffiliated stockholders, effectively cleansing the transaction in question and causing the transaction to be subject to review in accordance with the business judgment. Duty of loyalty. Each director must exercise his or her powers in the interest of the corporation and not in his or her own interest or that of another person or organization. The duty of loyalty has a number of specific applications. The director must avoid any conflicts of interest in dealings with the corporation and cannot extract personal benefits from the corporation that are not shared by all of the shareholders. The director must not personally usurp what is more appropriately an opportunity or business transaction to be offered to the corporation. For example, say an officer or director of the company was in a meeting on the company's behalf and a great opportunity to obtain the distribution rights for an exciting new technology was offered. It would be a breach of this duty to try to obtain those rights for himself and not first offer them to the corporation. Further, the director cannot act in bad faith and for a purpose other than advancing the best interests of the corporation. For example, the director cannot knowingly cause the corporation to violate the law, cannot consciously disregard his obligation to oversee the corporation's activities and thereby sanction misconduct by the corporation and its employees, and cannot waste corporate assets. The board's duty of loyalty impacts its role in M&A in numerous ways. Essentially, it means that a board member's decisions can only be driven by a desire to maximize shareholder value. A director would be violating this duty of loyalty if she supported a deal that benefited a company in which she had a stake solely because the deal would benefit her directly or indirectly. It would also be a breach of the duty of loyalty if she determined that one buyer of the company was better than another because that buyer promised her a bigger role after the sale. In short, directors cannot put their own interests before the company's. To the extent that interested directors play too large of a role on a board, the board risks losing the presumption of the business judgment rule, meaning that courts will scrutinize the decisions made by a board deemed not to be impartial with respect to a particular matter. To that end, in the context of considering M&A transactions or other situations in which one or more directors could be deemed to have misaligned interests, interested directors should consider recusing themselves from discussing and voting on relevant transactions. The board could also form a special committee comprised of only outside directors to control the sale process in order to avoid any potential conflicts of interest. Several recent Delaware cases have highlighted how the duty of loyalty impacts financial advisors in M&A transactions. The recent Del Monte, El Paso, and Rural Metro decisions in the Delaware Chancery Court have shown that courts are also concerned about disloyal financial advisors. But these cases implicate boards as well. Under this recent case law, boards have a responsibility to oversee financial advisors and be on the lookout for potential conflicts of interest. For example, a bank favoring buyers who will seek financing from that bank. In other words, the board must adhere to its Revlon duties throughout the sale process, not just at the approval stage, and the disloyalty of a financial advisor can lead to board liability. Boards need to always take their fiduciary duties very seriously, but this is particularly true in the context of M&A and related transactions, especially those that may be cross-border in nature. In order to do so, a diligent board may wish to hire independent counsel to advise it of its duties in the context of the particular situation the company is in. Boards should remain diligent in their oversight role and always play the role of constructive skeptic when political transactions and their alleged value propositions are presented for debate and appeal. In conclusion, Boards on both sides of any transaction will have the best chance to avoid bad deals with bad consequences, and the litigation that often follows them, if they remain steadfast in their focus on core principles of stewardship and on their key fiduciary duties, develop and encourage a sound M&A process, and are diligent about keeping records of their decisions and actions. Chapter 7. An Overview of Regulatory Considerations. Introduction. There is a wide variety of regulatory considerations in a merger or acquisition, with most of them falling into one of two categories. One, general regulatory issues affecting all types of transactions, and two, industry-specific regulatory issues that affect only certain types of transactions in certain industries. The general regulatory considerations include issues such as antitrust, environmental, securities, and employee benefits matters, which are discussed in this chapter. There are also industry-specific regulatory issues, with federal and/or state regulators exercising rights of approval over those transactions that involve a change in ownership or control, or that may have an anti-competitive effect on a given industry. Any transaction in the broadcasting, healthcare, insurance, public utilities, transportation, telecommunications, financial services, or even defense contracting industries should be analyzed carefully by legal counsel to determine what level of government approval may be necessary in order to close the transaction. Regulatory agencies such as the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, and the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, PBGC, have broad powers to determine whether a proposed transaction will be in the best interests of the consuming general public, or, in the case of the PBGC, the employees and retirees of a given seller. In certain regulated industries, these government approvals are needed in order to effectuate the transfer of government-granted licenses, permits, or franchises. These may range from the local liquor board approving the transfer of a liquor license in a small restaurant acquisition, to the need to obtain FCC approval for the transfer of multi-billion dollar communication licenses, such as the transaction between Verizon Wireless and Altel. Environmental laws. Prior to the 1970s, sellers normally had little or no legal obligation to disclose information concerning the presence or use of potentially hazardous substances on their premises, nor to report the release of such substances into the environment to the potential buyers of their business. What obligations did exist were imposed by state or local governments regulating public nuisances or engaging in emergency planning. In the 1970s and early 1980s, as the federal government passed new laws concerning health and the environment, it created new obligations to report on the presence, use, and release of hazardous substances under certain circumstances. The Clean Water Act, CWA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA, the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA, and the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, CERCLA, or Superfund, all contained provisions requiring notification of government authorities in the event of chemical releases and other emergencies. In addition, TSCA and regulations promulgated pursuant to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, required chemical manufacturers and others to compile and report information on the presence and use of certain chemicals on their premises. Each of these laws had a unique, limited scope, for example, covering some substances but not others, and the result was a patchwork of different but sometimes overlapping reporting requirements. In 1986, Congress enacted the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, EPCRA, found in Title III of the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act of 1986, SARA. Subchapter 1 of EPCRA creates a framework for state and local emergency response planning, and in that setting imposes on companies two types of reporting obligations. One, the obligation to provide information about the presence of extremely hazardous substances so as to facilitate emergency planning, and, 2, the obligation to notify authorities immediately in the event of a release. Subchapter 2 of EPCRA requires companies to file additional reports on the presence of hazardous substances at their facilities, and also to report on the period